Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing well.
You kind of cracked me up there saying goodbye to the guest in the chat room. That was
Hey, I guess.
You know, people come and go. It's okay. They come for what they need, and sometimes it's just the beginning of the spiel there. That's fine. You know, whatever you need from us, people, we're here for you.
Maybe they just need to be acknowledged. You know, hey, guest, that's all they needed, and, you know, they were out the door. So.
Exactly right. Exactly. So how are things in your world these days?
Well, this week, the big fun thing we did, now that the sun is going down a little later in the evening, around here it's about, the sun goes down about 8:08 is, I think, I checked it just the other day, see about when it goes down, about 8:08.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
So, you get off work, we went to the local lake and got out and went swimming and mess around the lake with the kids, and they had an awesome time. We had a good time with that. That was just right after work. So, don't have to wait for the weekend to have fun. You can get out and.
That's right. The days are longer, and if you live in Louisiana, it's already warm enough that you can go swimming in your local watering hole. Some places. We're having this very cold, rainy May in Colorado. Just like low pressure. It's kind of like all the rain we should have had in April, which it was pretty wet in April anyway. But it's like the longer days aren't helping us much at all. The temperatures have been like the 40s and 50s, and it's raining all the time. It just feels like, it's Seattle or San Francisco or London or something like that. And I haven't really gotten to do too much outdoors. I was trying to make a commitment. I was going to get on my bike and ride my bike every day. And last week the weather was pretty nice, and I did that. But this week it's just, it's gloomy and cold, and you don't feel like doing it.
I suppose you could if you were, you'd have to dress in basically a raincoat, head to toe kind of thing, huh?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to do it at all in the rain. I'm not going to try to ride a bike in the rain. I see people out in the snow riding their bikes. I'm just like, isn't it challenging enough, right? It's two wheels, staying balanced. I really don't need any addition. In fact, even after rain, the thing I've noticed is some of these trails I go on, you get this kind of gully washer thing going on, and you get these nice ditches, right, these little grooves and ridges and stuff. And if you're going up the hill, they're no big deal. They don't mean anything to you. You're just kind of bobbing and weaving around it. But when you're coming back down, you're building up some speed, suddenly you're going 25, 30 miles an hour. Those things are, like, lethal, right? I mean, they're just extremely dangerous.
It will put you on your butt quick, won't it? I mean, if you're not careful.
Well, they'll put you, on your head, tumbling down the mountain. Yeah, that's depending on how you hit them and how fast you're going. And it's not just the ditches, but it's like these sudden soft spots. This sudden thing where the wheels are going, suddenly, and you feel everything kind of sliding out from underneath you. But I mean, the adventure, I guess, is part of the fun of mountain biking anyway. You want to feel like there's something at stake, right? A little bit of skin in the game.
You left some skin on the rock behind you.
That's always a possibility. A little bit of road rash there. So anyway, enough about the outdoors. Our program this evening is going to be on the subject of, we're going to talk about gaming and education, and we're going to talk about how those two things work together, how those two things are changing, and what both of them might have to say about where our world is heading. And I'm not sure, do you have a preferred way of how you want to get into this? When we talk about gaming first, when we talk about education first, we didn't really do an outline. We just kind of came with topics.
You know, you do this long enough and we just get comfortable with knowing that it's going to come together one way or another. Let me just jump into Salman Khan a little bit. I want to kind of introduce, you know, some thoughts on him. Now, probably the best, if you're at all interested in Khan and Khan Academy, maybe one of the first things to do is listen to his TED Talk. Absolutely brilliant. You know, the man starts off doing, you know, trying to tutor his little cousins in math. And, you know, and that he tutors them in person, I gathered a couple of times. But, his job or his, you know, his schedule was such that it was better to just do a video. He had a whiteboard kind of thing that he was doing it with. And he would make a YouTube video and he would post it. And, you know, he had the option to make it a private video or a public video. And he saw no reason to make it private, you know.
Right.
So what if someone else uses this to learn, something? So
that would actually be a good thing. What the heck?
Yeah, it'd be a nice thing. So I'm putting it out there. There's nothing private in these videos. I'll put it out there. So his cousins took it and enjoyed it, and all of a sudden he started getting some feedback from other people, and it really started snowballing after that. And it was funny. One of the things he mentioned was that the cousins liked the videos better than him in person. And the thing, you know, think about this. Why would you prefer a video of a good teacher over a good teacher? Well, you know, there's no judgment ever from a video. If it takes you five times to understand the video, it will do it five times. You just keep playing it, and you know, things like that. And so, it's
You take lots of advantages. I mean, 10-minute doses, right? These are YouTube videos. The real Uncle Salman might go on and on and on for hours, right? This is like, well, 10 minutes and we're done. And you can always hit pause, right? So, I mean, there's just all kinds of.
What if I get, you know, 10 lessons ahead and I've learned, you know, and all of a sudden I realize, you know, I've kind of forgotten how to do, you know, I need to brush up again on multiplying fractions, you know. You can go back to that video. And so at any rate, he just kept doing more and more and more videos. Now he's gotten Bill Gates money behind him because Gates saw how good it was with his kids. And there's other people have joined in and are donating money to the cause. And so he's been able to, hire a programmer to come in and it allows tracking and keeping data of how an individual student progresses through these videos and through exercises. You do exercises, you have to do 10, you know, if one simple concept, you do 10 problems, you have to get every single problem right, and then you move on to the next thing. So it's a type of mastery learning. You don't, you have to demonstrate that you know how to do it completely, and then you move on to the next topic. And you know, there's like an educational tree as you're going through. You go out on different branches, and each thing builds on the last. And it's just an amazing concept. My kids are doing it, and as they're moving through, you know, they're getting badges and things like that. And it, you know, kind of getting into our other topic, it begins to feel like a game to them, and they help each other. You know, one will work on a problem and kind of get ahead in one area and kind of help tutor the other one. And that's something that apparently that they're seeing a lot of. They're using these videos that, you know, it turns the classroom upside down for teachers that are using it in class. It's not just for homeschoolers or something like that, although we're homeschoolers and we're using it. It's being used in actual classrooms where the teacher assigns the lecture in the form of a Khan video as homework, and then what used to be homework problem solving is then done in class with the teacher, you know, being the person to come, you know, go from group to group, and they're like, you know, they're working, and if there's any, if they're stuck on a problem, the teacher can jump in and help.
Let me see if I understand this. So the lecture portion of the class, the traditional classroom portion of the class, is done ad hoc outside of class, possibly even on the internet, watching a video, and then the homework portion, the thing that used to be the ad hoc, you do it on your own time thing, that's now what's done in the structured classroom setting.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
and they're finding that kids are teaching other kids, and that's, and they said this is huge. You know, when a person begins to teach themselves, I don't know about you, Phil, but the thing that I always has, you know, I've always learned things the best when I was trying to teach someone else.
That's right. Yeah.
And
years of training, right? I've delivered training for years, and that's how I've grown comfortable with any subject matter, is by actually standing up and explaining it to somebody else. When you have to do that, you have to know it. You know, I mean, it's just, it's as simple as that.
That's right. And you can, and there's nothing like that experience to really get kids into it. And they, it's really changing, you know, that alone, that one thing, the Khan Academy. Now, Khan, again, started out as math only. And in fact, the data thing, where it kind of keeps up with how the progress the kids are making, that's still at present, it's only for the math videos. Khan has done a lot more videos than the math videos now. He's gotten into science, he's got into history, he's done some other things. His ultimate goal is to have basically a K through 12 every subject in the form of Khan videos, and with all the same tracking data and everything, all for free, just like they've got now with mathematics. And I'm telling you, the videos start, you know, we're talking so simple, it's number line. Here are numbers on a number line. The one comes out, you know, the two comes after one, which comes, you know, before three. I mean, from very, very, very simple all the way up to advanced calculus, you know. So, I mean, he's very thorough in math, and now he's branched out into other areas as well.
Well, I've seen this article on thenextweb.com that you had linked on Twitter. They talk about how the Internet generally is revolutionizing education. There's a lot of examples given. We'll get into some of those others. But in the section on Khan Academy, it says that there are actually there are over 2,100 videos now in the Khan library. I mean, that's amazing when you think about it, that he's provided that many. But that's probably, I don't know, maybe 10% of where he's planning on going, if he's actually going to do what you just said, which is essentially to provide an entire education, an entire, not even primary and secondary education online.
That's right. That's right. Wow. And so put it this way. His full-time job now is making these videos. He does this, he does this as his full-time job. And the thing is,
How has he monetized this? Are there ads on the videos or?
Donations. Donations.
Oh, okay.
All you need is one Bill Gates and a couple of other people, and then, you know, and then people like me and you that can donate a buck or two every now and then on top of that. And,
right.
He's replaced the income he was making as an investment banker before. So, you know, he's doing okay.
Banker, I mean, you know, that's depending a pretty good living. So, I mean, that's pretty cool that he's changing the world and that he can make a living doing it. That's really amazing. I mean, when you look at that, you think the artifact of his work. When he puts this entire school together, this entire education together, and it's available online, you know, the world is just different when anybody who has a computer can get an education for free. And what Khan provides is the bottom-up approach to that. Now, there's also a top-down approach that was initiated with MIT when they started putting their courseware online for free, you know, some subset of their courseware. And other institutions have slowly but surely followed suit. You see, I see in this article that Harvard and Yale have both gotten in on this now. So Ivy League schools providing their courses to anybody who wants to take them for free. Now, you can't get a degree, which actually speaks to a related topic, the topic of the higher education bubble. It speaks to the fact that the product that these institutions of higher learning are really selling is not so much the information, which increasingly is available for free, and they're even making it available for free, but it's the credential. It's the certification that says, I went to this place, right? And additionally, I mean, not to say that that's not worth anything. I don't suggest that it means nothing to have completed a four-year degree at MIT. Obviously, that's a very nice credential to have, and it shows a tremendous amount of skill and capability getting in there in the first place and to have completed it. So, I mean, I don't mean to say that credential is not worth a lot. Obviously, it is, but it is a credential that's being sold. It's not the information, because increasingly that information is finding its way to people on its own. And I think it's really interesting why, actually, put it this way as a question, why do you think there's Open Yale? Why is there MIT free courseware? Why did these institutions start doing this?
You know, I'm not quite sure, except that, you know, you've heard the old phrase, information wants to be free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, perhaps they knew that this information was out there anyway. All they're doing is, you know, in a way, by putting it out there the way they are, the information is just a little more organized now. Maybe they're looking at it that way. And they're also, you know, perhaps promoting their brand in a way by putting it out there like that. It's a good question. I'm not sure, but I know it's a worldwide phenomenon because
everybody's doing it. Well, one of the things
even in India it's being done.
Yeah. Well, and in India they're doing it specifically because they want to reach this burgeoning population that has no opportunity to get to a formal institution of higher learning. So in India, you can see it's definitely a matter of they recognize the need. We've got a population that we need to educate. We're going to push this information out so that people get it. I mean, you see things like I was really surprised to see the Stanford Mini Med School featuring I'm reading from the article here, featuring 3-year-long series of courses by more than 30,000 distinguished faculty, scientists, and physicians. Now, again, I'm assuming you go through that and you still don't have a medical degree from Stanford, right? But that is substantial knowledge that people are picking up from completing a program like that, or even participating a little bit in a program like that. And I think there are probably two ways of looking at why they're doing it, my own theory. And I think you hit the nail on the head with the first one. Let me put it this way. I think there's a way of looking at it that reflects completely positively on these institutions of higher learning, and then there's one that looks a little more like, oh yeah, that's the real reason, okay. And I think the one you said, the first one, is more there's the real reason, right? They're advertising themselves. They're putting it out there that look at all our awesomeness, and you figure young people will take a few free courses and they'll be all the more inspired to go to MIT. So it's kind of an advertising tool, it's kind of a recruiting tool. I think the other side of it is, ultimately, doing this speaks to what any of these universities will tell you is their actual mission, right? Because maybe they're in the business of selling credentials, but if you find a mission statement or, you know, some founding document for any of those universities, what they really claim to be about is teaching people, is making the information free. So I think the good version – well, actually, you answered – you came up with both my answers, Stephen. You nailed me. So I don't know why I'm even talking. You said both. But basically, yeah, I think that's right. I think they're marketing themselves, and I think they really are trying to, you know, educate people. At the end of the day, I think these institutions, as problematic as they might be in a lot of ways, are true to the idea that they want people to learn.
Yeah, I believe that, and it's a little of both. It's a little of both, and I think that these programs have been very well received. I mean, if if MIT's initial effort had fallen flat on its face, I don't think we would be seeing, you know, Stanford and Harvard and Yale and these other institutions following suit. But they are now.
And I think that's another reason maybe that they're doing it, right? Once two or three are doing it, it's like they all kind of have to, don't they?
Right.
I
would imagine that, you know, lesser schools could put things out like this, but they wouldn't be as highly watched or looked at as these schools that everybody has heard of, you know.
Sure. And I think I think other schools are doing it. State schools are doing it. It seems to be a very prominent trend now that everyone's providing some free stuff over the internet. It's almost become kind of expected that everyone will. Now let's look at the bottom up options, because there are several more that are mentioned in this article, and I think they're really interesting. I had not heard of a lot of these, but they sound fascinating. Skillshare, this site from New York City that basically lets people learn anything from anybody else. So it's kind of like a do-it-yourself Khan Academy. I love the idea about that one because, to your point earlier, it seems that it capitalizes on the idea that we learn best by teaching, and it gives anyone who's got something important to share a role. It's like now we can all be Khan, right? Because that's such an inspiring story. This guy starts out, he wants to teach math to his cousins, and now he's transforming education as we know it. People look at that and go, gee, I wish I could do something like that. Well, at Skillshare you can. If you know something and you have something that you can share with others, you can be the teacher. You can be the person to provide that learning to someone else. I think that's a really powerful idea. There was another one we were talking about right before the show started, and I can't remember which one it was, Stephen, but you were raving about one of these.
Open culture.
Open culture. Tell us about that.
Well, open culture, it has, I mean, thousands of hours of audiobooks. I mean, that's a huge part of it is audiobooks. So, I mean, if you're interested in, you know, hearing a good book, that's a good place to go. I mean, this stuff is free. I guess primarily that's how I've used it. But, there's also, basically, pretty put to you this way, there are videos about just about anything you can imagine, and it's always growing. In some ways, it's like the skill set, except that instead of it being individual teachers teaching an entire course, it could be like, maybe I'm not going to teach a whole semester long course or something on the topic, but I can take 5 minutes to show how. So, to do a video on, solving the Rubik's Cube or anything. And you can go to Open Culture and you can find stuff like that. So, you've got classic movies, you've got audiobook materials, you've got, existential, I mean, risks.
Yeah, I've
seen
the existential Star Wars, Sartre meets Darth Vader, right? So it goes to show you that it's not all just traditional subject matter.
Yeah, exactly.
That the top-down approach and even the Khan Academy approach, they're going to take you through the traditional academic information, whereas open culture, I mean, this is the words say it all, right? It's going to be cultural information, and it's pretty open as to what the approach to that's going to be and what you're going to get out of it.
Absolutely. And I have found that sometimes it's culture is as important as any other kind of information. You know, I mean, the ability to be able to draw from culture, remix it, and put it back out there again. That's in some ways that's an important writing skill. It's an important skill in, just being able to speak to others in a group. I mean, it's and so it's a great learning experience. I recommend Open Culture to anybody. It's fun too. It's a fun website.
Yeah, I'm gonna spend some time there. I never heard of it until today when I was reading this article, and you and I got to talking about it before the program. I definitely intend to spend some time there and on Skillshare. And I love the idea that people are taking control of this process, not only control of sharing information, but also control of defining what information is important and actually creating new content. You know, you can go to Skillshare, and if your skill is whatever it might happen to be, you know, you and I, Stephen, we could do a thing on podcasting, right? Or maybe we should take one. But
yeah,
well, one way or another, right?
Should we teach it or sit at the feet of someone else?
that would fit in. It would not be part of a traditional academic program, but it's important knowledge people need today. And you have the situation where the circumstances that we're in, the technology that we have, the economy that we have, the constant acceleration and shift of how we interact with each other all provide new opportunities for topics, for things, for people to teach each other about.
Hey, I note in the chat room, Sally says that Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom is now on YouTube. And so that's pretty cool. Yeah, and some of these old things how old's Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom?
Well, that's old, man. That's when I was a little kid. Yeah, that goes way back.
Yeah, it goes way back. But I mean, that was some great stuff back when I love watching that. It was like, what was it, Sunday night? I forget. But anyway, that stuff, you don't lose it. I mean, nowadays, things like that, you can find these things online, you know, stuff that you hadn't seen in years and years. So, and YouTube is, they have a whole section of YouTube devoted to educational type programming. So check out YouTube as well. Get on there and just, you know,
basic
search.
YouTube. And there's also Apple has iTunes University. There,
that's right.
Actually, I need to put the link up on the site. It's also in Stephen's Twitter feed, but actually on the Speculus for this article on how the internet is revolutionizing education. There are so many options that I had no idea. I mean, we were talking about this earlier, just the fact that this is a subject we've been tracking for years now on this program. And a few years ago it was, well, you know, MIT provides their courseware for free, and there's Wikipedia, and, oh, this guy Khan. And that's all still true, but now there are so many more options that I think have just come online the last couple or 3 years and that are coming online now. It's really it's really exciting to see how many just different opportunities there are for people to educate themselves.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and I think the, you know, one thing we're going to see a lot more of is stuff like what Khan is trying to build, where students – actually are able to get a credential in a way. Now, I mean, what kind of is doing is basically, you know, just basically giving you like an online badge. You know, you can, your record there in the Khan Academy shows that you completed these areas and, you know, for covering this much, you know, you got a Meteor badge because you went through like 10 lessons in a week, that kind of thing. And, you know, stuff like that, It provides the opportunity for you to turn learning into a game, and I think that's there's huge potential there.
I think so too. Well, you know, we've seen this notion of gamification, as we call it in the social media biz, because you need dorky words like that if you're going to be in the Web 2.0 world. Gamification of business functions has become all the rage. This idea that we can make environments more attractive, more usable, make people more engaged and more involved in doing things if it's more like playing a game. The great example of that in the Web 2.0 world, I guess, is now the URL escapes, Mint.com, this company that has taken personal financial management and turned it into essentially a game. So you're managing your finances, which is beneficial to you, but you're playing a game, which is fun. So you're getting the benefit of getting better and better at taking care of your money, But you're motivated to do it because you enjoy playing a game. And I see that kind of dynamic applied to education. You know, tremendous things can happen. I mean, a lot of kids are pretty excited about learning. But I think when they are, it's because there are aspects of learning that are similar to gameplay. There's the, you know, the idea of being introduced to a challenge and taking that challenge on and getting to the next level, and a lot of the things that that make playing a game fun can make learning fun too. And this kind of takes us to our other topic, which was actually, it's about a year old TED talk from Jane McGonigal from the Institute for the Future that I put up on the site earlier this week. I tweeted it over on my Transparency Revolution Twitter feed. And it was just one of those things like, oh, that's funny. This woman says you were going to save the world by playing games. And I was one of those, well, that sounds kind of interesting. I better watch that. So I you know, stopped and took 20 minutes out of my day and watched a video and ended up blogging it on The Speculist, not on my Transparency Revolution blog, just because I was so impressed by what she had to say. And what she had to say makes so much sense. She starts out with this really radical proposition. She says she wants to make it as easy to save the world in real life as it is to save the world in online games. And ultimately, she wants to persuade more people to play bigger and better games. She starts out, she gives this really interesting statistic. I thought it was interesting. She says, currently the world spends about 3 billion hours a week playing games. If you count all the game time that all the game players in the world spend playing games, is about 3 billion hours a week, which is kind of a staggering amount of time when you think about it. But her take is, and this was a year ago, so it's probably the number's probably higher now, but she wants to see that number multiplied by 7. Okay, she wants to see 21 billion hours of gameplay taking place every week. And she says, if we can get to that stage, if we can get that level of gameplay going, then we've got a real shot at developing the skills, at people learning how to solve problems to the extent that we'll really be ready to take on problems like hunger, poverty, climate change, the kinds of problems that we talk about naturally being solved through emerging technologies and emerging possibilities on this program. And, you know, this is such a provocative thesis because games do not have the reputation of saving the world. When you talk, right, when you talk to somebody about people playing games for 3 billion hours a week, I think the gut reaction to that is, oh, my God, what a waste of time, right?
Yeah.
If only those people were spending their time productively. But according to Jane McGonigal, they are spending their time productively because they are experiencing an evolutionary process. And it's really – have you seen this video?
Yes, I have. I watched it today.
Oh, okay. So you know this picture she shows. She shows this photograph of a gamer who is on the edge of what
picture.
She describes as an epic win. Yeah. I mean, the look on that kid's face, right? So intense. And she goes into the nuances of, you see his eyes are wide. This means there's optimism. He's very focused. There's fear. All of these emotions playing out at the same time. But just this very extreme experience of, I was up against a huge challenge. I was up against a huge problem. And I can overcome this. And the feeling that gives a person is like nothing else. And she contrasts that feeling with what she calls the I'm not good at life feeling, which is a feeling that she says gamers and all of us experience all the time. It's this, you know, in our real lives, we don't get to make a lot of epic wins. We don't enjoy a lot of the happy, fun characteristics that seem to come naturally and flow naturally into gaming environments. She talks about how in game worlds we become actually better versions of ourselves because we're more willing to stick to trying to solve a problem. We're more willing to cooperate with others, and we're more willing to pick ourselves up and keep going when things get tough. So for some reason, games make us more optimized to achieving the right outcome than real life does. And according to Jane McGonigal, we've got to figure out what that formula is and get that into real life. And I think that's an excellent idea.
Well, I was, you know, in you know, a social game like World of Warcraft, you know, people, you know, work cooperatively and they, you know, quickly form ad hoc groups and things like that. It's just, it, you know, that sort of thing, you know, certainly they're not accomplishing much within that game world that affects, you know, life out here in the real world. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. You know, other games could be constructed that take advantage of the same kind of, you know, the same kind of structures of World of Warcraft, what we learned from those games, and brought in and make new games that actually do productive things. And she had made three games, I think, she mentioned that she had actually come up with, and she talked a little bit about what these games accomplished.
Absolutely, yeah. Through the Institute for the Future, she's done three games. One of them was called World Without Oil.
And that's right.
Interesting, like role play game around a scenario where peak oil has occurred. So people are actually learning skills for dealing with a severe oil shortage. Now, you know what's interesting about that is how fun could that be? Right? I mean, when you hear it. But it must have been very compelling. They had 1,700 people playing it, and they played for 3 years, and apparently it was profoundly impactful on these individuals who played, to the point that they actually live their real lives differently now related to energy consumption. Then the big one, this is the one I heard about. I remember when this one came out, Superstruck. It was a scenario where a supercomputer has calculated that humans have only 23 years left, okay? 23 years, and then we're going to be extinct. So we've got to save humanity. So they put a dream team together, and she likens it in the video to a like a Jerry Bruckheimer film, where you always get, you know, the team together. You got the astronaut and the ex-con, and everybody's got a role to play, and it's important that everybody gets brought in to save the world. And only in this case, everybody who got to play was a member of the dream team. And I guess 8,000 people played this game over a period of 8 weeks, and they came up with 500 really creative ideas about how to save the world, how to keep humanity from going extinct. You know, and that's a fairly limited time compared to some of the stats that she gives about World of Warcraft. Just to swing it back there for a minute, I've got this written down here in my notes someplace, and this is really interesting. Yeah, World of Warcraft players have spent 5.93 million years playing World of Warcraft. That's what that, you know, 3 billion hours of gaming a week adds up to in terms of just the World of Warcraft statistic. And she points out that that's about the same period of time, and this was a year ago, so, you know, the number's going to be higher now. That's about the period of time that has passed since primates first walked upright. So we talk about, right, Australopithecus.
Since hominids got off their knuckles and started walking upright.
Right, from Lucy to here. That's how much time has been spent playing World of Warcraft. And her point about that is, you know, again, is not, oh, my God, what a spectacular waste of time, but rather we have to look at gaming in evolutionary terms. We have to look at it as this, you know, we talk about the singularity occurring, and suddenly for this new artificial intelligence, this human-level intelligence that exists in the computer substrate, operating a million times faster subjectively than we do. Well, this is kind of the same idea. You've distributed, right? So now you've got a million years worth of experience doing something, or in this case, 6 million years worth of experience doing something spread out over this population. But the evolutionary potential is there. The potential for us to move in really interesting and exciting new directions is there just because of the sheer amount of time that we're putting into this. And this is the other thing she talks about. I thought this was really interesting. She says in a gaming culture, and this would be countries like the U.S., Western Europe, South Korea, places where gaming is really prominent and popular, by the age of 21, kids have spent 10,000 hours playing games. And she points out that statistic is important for two reasons. For one, that is the same as how much time you will spend in school, in formal education, from the fifth grade through high school. And also, in the book, you've heard of this book, Outliers, by Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes.
Yeah. that's the magic number there. According to Gladwell, if you want to be a virtuoso piano player, tennis player, anything, if you want to be world-class anything, the way to get there is to have spent 10,000 hours doing it by the time you reach age 21. If you can get those 10,000 hours in, you can be among the best of the best. And here we have a whole generation of kids, like 500 million people worldwide, who are about to hit that mark. There's 10,000 hours by age of 21. So, you know, taking it back to education just for a minute, we are educating this generation, or they're educating themselves, in a whole new set of skills, and they are taking themselves to virtuoso level performance, world-class level performance, hundreds of millions of people with these skills. 500 million worldwide, and she says there will be another billion added within the next decade because of the rapid growth of gaming in China and Brazil and India, places like that. And here's what she says we're becoming virtuoso at, and you know, this is the kind of stuff I really just lap up. I just love this so much. What are we getting good at by playing all these games? And when I say we, I mean we as a species. I personally don't play games. Are you much of a gamer, Stephen?
Yeah, I like, you know, I play role playing games both online and around the table. So yeah, I'm a gamer.
Well, you know, and a bona fide geek too, I would say, right? If you're playing around
absolutely.
The table, yeah, for sure. How about your boys? Are they going to hit 10,000 hours? You think by age 21?
Oh, easily now. They're not as old school as I am. You know, I like rolling the dice sometimes, you know, and just gathering around the table with fellow geeks, you know.
Put on your funny hat and, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, get in, you know, put on the wizard cap. And, I'm just kidding. but, yeah, lighting the candle, lowering the light.
It's a helmet of invisibility, okay?
have you been watching the show Community at all?
No, I don't want to.
Okay, I just throw that out there to our audience. If you haven't, you know, search for it online. You can watch episodes are online now. Just an absolutely brilliant show, and gaming culture makes some important appearances within that show. Anyway,
role playing gaming, like traditional sitting around Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah,
stuff?
Yeah.
I got to check that
hilarious.
Out. I got to see that. That's
hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. And well done, and you know, in a way that you know it appeals. It would appeal to any gamers out there. It's just very very funny.
I got to check that out. So here are the characteristics. Here I sidetracked, but here's what we're becoming virtuoso at, according to Jane McGonigal. First. Urgent optimism. Obviously, I love the sound of that. She says, extreme self-motivation to tackle an obstacle with a reasonable belief in success. Next, social fabric. Gamers, she says, are weaving this tight social fabric. They're building bonds. They're building trust. They're creating like this whole new kind of virtual community. Something she calls
blissful. You might call it social networking.
Say again?
You might call it social networking.
It is. What it is. Yeah.
You know, think about it this way: World of Warcraft, you know, was social networking. You know, it's gaming with a little bit of social networking built in. And now the social networks are finding that some of the the biggest things that people do with Facebook are games. You know, so you know it's the line between social networking and gaming, at least online, is pretty blurry.
Well, I think they're very closely connected. Look at Farmville, right? I mean, that is essentially this social phenomenon. A lot of these apps on the iPhone, you know, it's like, are we playing a game or are we engaged in social networking with each other? The two things are completely interrelated. And I think when she talks about forming a social fabric, that maybe it's even going beyond the network, right? It's like society itself. It's like we're forming a whole new society within the game world. And I think probably for some World of Warcraft folks, it really feels that way. That like their real community to some extent is this people they're interacting with in that world, because of the other things that are going on, the urgent optimism, the next one being the blissful productivity. This is an interesting stat. I didn't realize this. How many hours a week does the average World of Warcraft player play World of Warcraft? Do you remember from the video?
About 22.
22 hours a week. You know, that's more than half of a full-time job right there. And why?
No, I simply would not have time for that because I have a full-time job and I've got a family to come home to and need to spend time with. But, you know, obviously a huge amount of time is being poured into that, you know, I'm not one to judge on that. I just think that, I'm with McGonagall. I think that there are ways to harness that and to make something productive come from it.
Well, the thing to learn from that, and it's true, you know, nobody has time for that, but they find time because it becomes so compelling to them, right? It's like nobody has money for cocaine until you're addicted, right? And then, you know, maybe that's a bad example, but you know what I'm saying? Suddenly, people who would maybe have claimed they didn't have time for it, they start playing World of Warcraft and they're spending 22 hours a week. Why? What's so compelling? What is it that's making them do that? She calls it blissful productivity. These people are completely engaged in what they're doing. They feel that they're solving a problem. They feel that they're part of a team who is learning together. They're growing together. They're achieving something together. And that ultimately we're happier doing hard work than we are doing nothing. That it's more engaging to do something like be in World of Warcraft. I've never played World of Warcraft, but I'll take your word for it. That it's more engaging to be inside World of Warcraft, to be solving a mission, to be, you know, completing a mission, solving a problem, defeating an enemy, you know, rescuing the innocent, whatever it is that goes on in there. Than it would be just to sit down and watch a TV show about that. It is very compelling for people to have something that they feel like is important to do. And it goes back to this dichotomy between epic win versus I'm not good at life. In your actual job, you do get the blissful productivity sometimes, but you often, for most people, I think, often find yourself up against a lot of ambiguity, find yourself up against a lot of work that is more like a chore than it is I guess the bottom line is it's not always as obvious when the next epic win is coming in the regular work life versus in the World of Warcraft life where it's kind of built into it. And then finally, the last one she gives is epic meaning, and I think that applies that applies too. People want to be attached to a big, meaningful mission. They want to feel like they're really part of something and that they're really making something happen. And it's at that point that she talked about these games that they've invented via the Institute for the Future. And I think she's really onto something. I don't know that the world is going to be saved by these particular games that they're coming up with, but it feels to me like even as businesses are beginning to recognize the power of gaming, and educators are beginning to recognize the power of gaming, the internet becomes this pervasive environment for us to do everything, including work and be educated, that I think, you know, my theory is that we're heading towards a world where essentially most of what we do is going to seem very game-like at best. If we do it correctly, and I don't mean game-like in that it will be trivial or it'll be fantastic. I mean it'll be game-like in that we will have learned how to incorporate these qualities into what we're doing. Because what could be more beneficial to an educational process than having kids approach that with urgent optimism, right? A really tight social fabric, this feeling of blissful productivity, this feeling of epic meaning. Right, and likewise, doesn't that sound like a great job?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm just reminded that, you know, of young kids, very young kids playing. You know, to me, there's nothing more productive for a young child to do than to spend hours and hours and hours in play. I mean, it's extremely important for learning. You know. You know, both, you know, kids can play, you know, by themselves sometimes, but you know, playing with others is very, very much more important. You know, the social give and take involved in playing is extremely important. And so, you know, there's no need to lose that as we get older. you know, the excitement about learning new things, excitement about trying new things, and meeting new people and facing new challenges. All of these can be put in a gaming type environment, and it can lead to real productivity here in the real world. So, yeah, I'm excited about where this is going. I think it'll be an important part of the future.
I think so too. Well, and I think it goes to one of our other issues that we talk about. The Cory Doctorow and Martin Ford shows from last year when we got into this question about what happens to the economy when we're, you know, in a world where all of the normal productive work is outsourced to computers. And I remember when Alvis Bridges was on, we got into the same discussion talking about the future of Facebook. You know, what are people going to do? What's going to happen to work? What's going to happen to the idea of people being engaged and involved in the economy? And Alvis talked about how important role that games would have to play in future economic activity. And I think I feel like I want to bring Alvis back on and have that conversation again, because I feel like I'm ready to have it now, having learned a little bit more about this, and particularly having watched this video a couple of times, because I think the thing I wasn't seeing before when we were talking about this is these characteristics of urgent optimism, this idea of really feeling like you're on a mission, that you've got something important to do. You know, I had this idea of, well, what? How's anybody going to get paid to play Farmville? You know, and it's actually getting paid to play Farmville is not the point at all. The point is that no matter what gets made, no matter what side of productivity gets made automated, there will always be problems that need to be solved, and people will continue to have a role to play in solving them. And it seems to me that if we put them together correctly, gaming interfaces or game-like structures, social structures, stand to be the best way to solve those problems. So I don't know, still don't know how you get paid for doing that. We're gonna get back into this new economy and the World Transform 2 in a few weeks, and hopefully we'll completely work that all out. But the idea makes a lot more sense to me now than it did a few weeks ago or a few months ago when we talked to Alvis about it. That's for sure.
Well, I look forward to reading Jay McGonigal's book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. I bought it on Kindle like 10 minutes, actually earlier today. So I've only just begun that book, and maybe I can report back a little bit about what's in it.
So is her thesis there, Reality is Broken? Again, that's talking about the problems that the world faces. Is that the basic idea?
Yes, and apparently, if reality is broken, we can fix it within virtual reality. So, I'm just now kind of getting the flavor of the book. It's I hope to be able to report back in the next week or so.
Well, let's do the one I'm going to read is tell you what, you read that, and I'll read Outliers. One of the things we were talking about earlier is that there probably always were. But now there are just too many books for anybody to read, right? how was it you put it earlier? I thought you really gave it a Kurzweilian spin. What did you say?
Well, as we approach the singularity, the time between this absolutely indispensable books decreases exponentially. It seems
there
like
it is. Yeah.
there's an important book, and then, you know, when I was a kid, it was like an important book. 2 or 3 years ago, by, there's another important book. And,
once a decade or so, yeah, a big important book would come along.
We don't have to wait that long anymore.
Now you get one every few days, faster than some of us are able to incorporate into our reading lives. But here's what interests me about the Malcolm Gladwell thing. I'm taking that it's 10,000 hours by the time you turn 21 from McGonagall. Because other than I go, okay, well, I'm not 21 anymore. Can I spend 10,000 hours and become a virtuoso? It's something I'm kind of interested in that, because it goes back to the idea of educating ourselves and what we do with our lives in a new economy. Because it seems to me that one of the most powerful motivations that people would have for interacting in a social fabric, in a game-like environment, would be to increase their skills, to become really, really awesome at something. And I just wonder if, you know, surely that possibility exists for those of us who have passed 21. Maybe we'll never be the world-leading virtuosos, but a certain level of competence that we can achieve, and that is available to us because all these resources are here for us to learn these things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well,
here's hoping. So I guess that takes us to our music.
The music tonight is by Georgie K, and the song is Back to Back.
Back to Back by Georgie K. Okay, well, thank you, Stephen, as always, for putting that together. Enjoyed talking to you, as always. Thanks for our friends in the chat room. Great chat going on this evening. We didn't engage you guys as much as we normally like to, but thanks for keeping it going there. Remind you that The World Transformed will begin June 29th and will run through August 31st. We'll be putting announcements up, and there will be a website dedicated to that. Look for information on that on The Speculist. We'll be back on with The World Transformed 1.5 on Saturday evening. A new archive show will be listed early part of next week, and, of course, we'll be back on live again this time next week. We hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming programs, and until next time, live to see it.
Back to back with you, over the water, reading something I never knew. Feel let sinking deep underneath my skin. And one of these days, I'll be wrestling with the beast within. Back to back with you. I got that feeling, never thought I would get through.